Thank you, Paul. Well, you know, I have to say I've been doing this for a long time. They are endlessly fascinating. I usually try to draw some kind of, put some kind of context around the evening's interviewee, the person we're going to be talking to for the next hour or so. And I have to say, I think Dean Kamen will be unlike anybody that we have talked about, and unlike anybody that you will probably meet in your lifetime other than in this evening. We're going to talk about healthcare products. We're going to talk about non-healthcare products. But this is a truly fascinating story as I've gotten to know it, and I think we're in for a real treat tonight. I'm also going to leave a little bit more time for Q&A tonight because I think that there is a lot to get into here. Usually the issue I have, particularly, frankly, we've had some business executives on the program, has been to draw folks out. How do you fill an hour with guys who are, by inclination, prone to keep things close to the vest? I think the issue tonight will be keeping it all in within the next hour. So, Dean, thanks very much for being here. It's really a pleasure. Several of the folks that we've had here in the past were precocious. They started early on in life. But nobody, I think, with anything like your first project. Talk to us, before we get into the medical stuff, about the project you did in high school around the AV systems and your first efforts to try to kind of build an engineering and product design development effort.
First, I'll tell you, don't try this at home. I think what he's referring to, and this story has gotten bigger over time, but I assure you it's true. When I was in high school, it was the year that basically General Electric had just announced the invention of the SCR, the silicon controlled rectifier, Triax. Shows you how old I am to the students. I personally think it was the cause of, for instance, the disco age. So not all technology is good. But, you know, we were in a time when a few years before that it was exciting that you could buy a transistor radio and transistors could handle a few milliwatts. An SCR could handle a kilowatt. As a result of that, you'd see people, instead of connecting speakers to their amplifiers, they'd connect lights, and hence the age of synchronized disco. I saw those lights or those power things and decided I could build these things for bands, have a summer job. I started doing it, and in a story that I'll dramatically truncate, I ended up building basically the system that ran the Laserium show in the Hayden Planetarium in the museum in New York, the largest planetarium in the world at the time. And as a result of making lots of money as a kid, I ended up filling up my parents' basement with electronic stuff and hiring my younger brothers friends to come after school, and I set up a little assembly line in their little tract home on Long Island. And soon I had forced my mother to take her washing machine, dryer, pantry, everything out of the basement, stuck them up in the kitchen because my company was expanding in her basement. She was a teacher, so summer was, she had off. My father was an artist, and still is an artist, and self-employed. And with four kids, they had never gotten to take vacations, putting us all bring us up. So I decided I'd made enough money not only to buy all the stuff I needed, but I would send my parents on a cruise. And I bought a pair of tickets and sent them off, the first vacation I can recall them having. And literally on the day that I sent them off, I had bulldozers come to their house, dug an 8-foot hole in the backyard, the size of the backyard, poured a set of walls that would connect the boundaries of their yard to what was the now exposed back foundation wall of their house, bashed out the concrete foundation wall, made their basement the size of their lot, which gave me a huge opportunity to expand my business and put a full machine shop in there before we covered the thing. then figured I'd cover it and give my mother a great new enlarged kitchen for all that crap I had put upstairs. And everybody'd be happy. She'd have a nice new addition to the house. My father'd have a den. I'd have a nice big shop in the basement.
Were they happy?
Well, I thought I could get it done during the week that they were gone. They got home to find most of the yard piled up against the back of the house, concrete trucks, neighbors. It was not a pretty sight. But it all worked out in the end. they loved it.
We can talk later about what you learned about deadlines on projects. But tell us now, obviously you showed an early genius for invention and for coming up with intriguing ideas. Where did the interest in medical devices in particular start, and what was your first major success in the device space?
In this very same basement, I had an older brother who is way more rational than I am. Brilliant guy, MD, PhD student. He's only 3 years older than I am. I was barely trying to get through high school. He was getting both his MD, his PhD. He was on the faculty at Yale Medical School in pediatric hematology oncology at the age of about 20. And he'd come home on weekends ripping mad and frustrated that they didn't make, for instance, drug delivery systems small enough to treat babies with leukemia. And, you know, frankly, it's because there's no market for it. I wasn't smart enough to know there's no market for it, that mostly IV pumps are for adults who get sick and stay sick for a long enough time to fill up hospitals. But he needed a way to make a tiny little device to deliver very, very small amounts of drugs to 2 and 3 pound babies. So I'd go down into my machine shop and my electronic shop and build this stuff for him. And he would use it, and I guess he was proud of his brother's accomplishments. Then he went off and did a little guest residency up at Harvard and took it there. And he would sort of show this thing off, and it was small enough to fit in an isolette, but because it was that small, at one point, months after I had made something for the medical guys among you, Vincristin, Cisplatin, Adriamycin, Methotrexate, every specialty drug, trust me, these are not huge markets. I was custom making these things. He calls me one day back at Yale, and he says, I met these guys that think your pump is so small, they could actually clip it on somebody's belt and send them home and give them chronic basal rates of insulin for diabetes. So I go up to visit these guys, and they tell me, this may seem obvious to you now, everybody, you know, standard of care, but they said, well, it wasn't the average person they wanted to wear this pump. They wanted to put them on pregnant women. It was well known even back then that babies start to develop, and a pregnant woman who's a diabetic will have blood glucose of 200, 300. Yours is all about 110 milligrams per deciliter. By the time the baby starts to develop a normal, healthy pancreas and it's seeing all this umbilical blood is hugely rich in glucose, these babies would become macrosomic, trying to bring the whole mother under regulation. And typically, they wouldn't go full term. They wouldn't be healthy. So these guys are explaining to me for the very specific purpose. This always gets lost when all the geniuses talk about how it was obvious that all diabetics should have tight glucose control. But these docs were basically saying, if we could just keep these women under very tight control instead of one shot a day or two shots a day for 9 months, it would be great. I was already smart enough. I was a great business guy by then. And my brother had lent a few of these pumps to some other adult docs for giving chemotherapy because he's an oncologist. And I had already seen what happens when you ask a person back in those days to wear a great big pump. I mean, it's a little bit bigger than this. For 6 or 8 weeks of a course of therapy, and most of them after a very short time wouldn't do it. Literally, they're not compliant with the therapy, which astounded me, but this is the real world. And they not only are not compliant, but their alternative is, you got cancer, you're not going to get, you're probably going to die. They're not compliant. So I'm listening to these docs, and I gave them free marketing insight advice and said, look, doc, I'm happy to modify the pump for you. I'll set it up with bolus and basal and all you want. I'll go build you your pumps. But women are not going to wear this thing for 9 months. We can't get people to wear it for 5 months or 5 weeks if their life depends on it. These guys start laughing and said, Dean, you don't get it. I believe you, but cancer patients, any kind, they won't wear this stuff. You don't understand. If we told a pregnant woman that she'd have a healthier baby, she'd strap a refrigerator or and she'd wear it for 9 months. I said, okay. So I built these guys about a dozen of these pumps, built them what they want. They put them on these patients. Every one of these women had a full-term healthy baby. It became a major article in the New England Journal and other places. And instantly, I went from a guy who was building specialty weird little pumps for hopefully orphan diseases that my brother was trying to treat, to building a piece of technology that was treating the most common chronic disease in North America.
Now, at some point, you have to commercialize these things in order to get them in wide distribution. It's one thing to talk to a bunch of doctors. How did you commercialize that insulin pump, and who did you go to? And give us a little bit of that sense, because I think that was kind of the beginning of a career which has seen a lot of these technologies come to the market.
Well, actually, as I said, I was quite skeptical that they would get patient compliance, and I was quite skeptical that they would get such outstanding results and that there'd be a particularly large business for that very customized pump. But I was by then building probably literally a dozen different kinds of these pumps. And most of the big pharmaceutical companies were leaving me alone. They didn't care. I was just another way to deliver this stuff. And the companies that were making hardware, like the iMeds and IVAX of the world, didn't care. These were all specialty niche products. But I was building them with a small group of people, and we were doing very well. I didn't have a lot of marketing people, but I had this trick. When I'd visit hospitals, I would say to the doctors, "What do you need?" It's a trick question, but they would generally answer it, and then I'd build it for them, and it seemed to work. But anyway, once we built that insulin pump, there was sort of, I think, a naive euphoria in the marketplace, and all of these people and these big companies, both the pharmaceutical companies and the hardware companies, could do the math. 2 million diabetics, now there's 21 million, include type 2 diabetics. They're all going to need these things. What a huge market. And they were all, I think, in exuberance about getting into it. I believed until people could build really reliable continuous glucose monitors and do closed loop, other than these women that were on a mission, it would not likely be something that would really be accepted. So when all the big companies were fighting over who was going to buy this product that I didn't believe would, at least for the next 10 years, become a standard of care, I sold the whole company.
To Baxter
Healthcare.
How did you make the connection to Baxter, and was it simply that they were willing to pay more than any other? Because you would have a long, fruitful relationship with Baxter. Why Baxter, and how did you make that connection?
Actually, they weren't willing to pay me the most money.
Oh, they weren't.
But right after some of these big articles came out with these spectacular results, all the big guys, I could name them, but you'd know who they are, the Baxter, and showed up. My mother'd make them chicken soup. I'd take them down, show them all the pumps. They all wanted to do this. But most of them wanted either me to go wherever they were or take the whole company and move it somewhere else. And I, by then, had a couple of hundred employees, a couple of dozen engineers, manufacturing, all sorts of people that I felt obligated to. And how do you make it all work? I didn't want to spend building a company, doing marketing, sales, manufacturing support. That's a lot of work. One thing you got to remember, building companies and running companies is a lot of work. You should only do the front end stuff that's fun. Anyway, Baxter came along and said, "Look, you know, we'd like you to work on other stuff for us, like dialysis equipment. We'd like you to do a lot of neat stuff. We'll take care of that other stuff. And since we don't have a group that does what you do, we'll leave the company where it is. We will give more security to the people doing your manufacturing, because we've got distribution globally, worldwide, et cetera." So they actually didn't offer us the largest amount of money, but they offered us the easiest way for me to transition back to doing front-end development. As part of their purchase of the company, I told them, "There's probably 24 people here that will not work for you. They wouldn't want to, and you probably wouldn't want them. They're quirky people. But I'll take those people, those are the creative people I work with, I'll set up a company, and we'll give you rights in the fields that you care about for some number of years to look at what we do in return for you making sure all the rest of these people have good careers. So you take care of this, you do what you do well, marketing, sales, distribution. We'll do what we do well, create a next generation of products. We'll work together with you, and everybody will be happy." We made that deal in the early 80s, and for the last 25 years, we've had a very, and continue to have a great relationship.
You still have a relationship with Baxter.
We built for Baxter a tiny little version of what was then a massive dialysis machine that they were putting in clinics. We told them we could build something that would sit by a bedside. Literally, even their internal people thought it was a pipe dream. I told them it would take a year and a half and cost a few million bucks. It was like the basement thing. Mm-hmm. It took 3 years and cost a bit more than that. We ended up getting it out, And I'm happy to tell you, last March, we shipped the 100 millionth therapy on that machine. It's the standard of care around the world now.
So the company you formed to continue to develop your own ideas was DECA. What was the company that you sold to Baxter? Was
that AutoSyringe.
That was AutoSyringe.
Yeah.
What was the nature of your relationship? And you obviously work with other companies. I mean, we talked about the important role Abbott played in sponsoring your appearance here. What's the nature of your relationship? Where do you see what DECA does ending and what the product company that you're working with, where does their role begin?
I'd be happy to tell you about all the relationships I have with all sorts of companies, even the alleged Abbott, but I'd have to kill you at the end of the evening. I can talk about all sorts of projects that we have done that are public. I can talk to you about all the stuff we do internally, but I never talk about the stuff we're doing for our clients while we're doing it. I will tell you, our relationship with most of the big pharma companies and most of the big medical device companies is pretty much the same, which is we have either generated some internal idea to do something that most people would think is nuts, and typically they're right. So we work on it for a while. I spend a lot of money, and around DECA, these are typically known as Dean's crazy ideas, and most of them are stupid. And at some point, we either decide it's not technically feasible, or maybe there's somebody else has come up with a better way to do it, and we shoot it. But we do it privately in our own place. We've lost our own money, so we're not humiliated by the outside world. Every once in a while, one of those crazy ideas becomes something that people say, wow, this would really be a big deal. And we then say, great, are we going to take the time and effort and energy to build a company and build distribution? No. You only get a few cycles of that in your life. So we then look around the world and say, what company out there would be the best at delivering this to the people that need it most? And we typically go see them. And I have enough of a relationship with most of these big guys that I'd call them and say, we have something that we think will interest you. In the early days, I used to go to them, whoever was the biggest and the best, we think this would interest you. And here's why. It's a better therapy, it's lower cost, it's more dignity for the patient, they can go home and do this. And we would hopefully convince them that they would bring, again, what they bring. Mm-hmm. Market reach, efficiency, distribution. And we'd go finish it up, working with their marketing people to make sure we get the details right. Then typically we either help arrange contract manufacturing for them, or if they do their own manufacturing, we bring it inside. One of the problems we started having was the old NIH syndrome. You know, you bring it to the big company, they've already got people internally working on some version of an incremental improvement of their already existing product. So I just started adding a little bit to the story. I'd go to them and say, well, here's my new thing. We think it's a really big idea. You're the biggest in the industry. We'd like you to have this. But if you want to give me all the reasons why it won't work and you don't want it, that's no problem. We'll bring it to your competitor. And one of you is going out of this business, and I'm agnostic.
Well, are you bringing them disruptive technologies, or are you bringing them improvements and enhancements on existing devices?
We don't do improvements on existing. Life is too short to do incremental stuff. We either crash and burn trying to do something that we just can't do, either because the technology's not there or we're dumb. We didn't get the right insight. But sometimes, just when a new technology gets there and we got the right insight and we can deliver something that the world just hasn't been able to do, that's where we put our energy. We get it to where we think we've taken most of the risk out of it. We've gotten to proof of concept. That's when we go and find the big guys to help us turn it from what would otherwise be a fun science fair project into something that could hopefully help a lot of people.
So I want to get to some of those projects because some of them are truly fascinating. I think many of them are well known among the audience here. Before we do that, you talk about working with big companies. Have you ever thought of something that you thought was so big and so exciting that, in fact, you wanted to start your own company around it? I mean, we're here in Palo Alto. I mean, you're from New Hampshire, where my guess is the number of venture capitals per square mile is relatively small. But we're here in Palo Alto, where, you know, some of them are working at Starbucks between fundings. Have you ever decided wanted to start your own company around a project?
Well, I've never worked for anybody. I've only started my own companies. Every project, I've never gotten a paycheck. But to me, starting a company around most of these things, while I know that maybe to the to the entrepreneurs among you, that's your goal. To me, it's the last resort. If you can't find somebody that's got a lot of resources, that knows how to do this, that can efficiently get there, either because your idea is too radical, then you start it on your own. But I think that's the last resort. I think if I focus my little company, which isn't so little anymore, I've got now almost 300 engineers.
Yeah.
By the way, I will shamelessly grovel and beg. The reason I'm here is three things. You're going to be committed to first. You're going to help me figure out how to put water and power around the world for the desperately poor that need it. And I need about another 20 more people. We have enormous opportunities, and I've dried up finding all the smartest, quirky people out there. And I've got 7 empty seats in my plane. You don't even have to pack. You can just come with me.
Do they have to live in New Hampshire?
They get the opportunity.
To live in New Hampshire.
Well, I mean, I know you're patriotic, and if you like, you know, the taxes and whatever else they have out here, but it's a nice place.
So the insulin pump and the drug delivery alone would be an extraordinary legacy. Let's talk about some of the other things. And I think, interestingly enough, if you're not in the healthcare field, the one thing that you probably are best known for is the Segway. But Segway comes from the iBot. Talk about the development of the iBot, where the idea came from, what you wanted to do with it, and then tell us how that led to the Segway.
Well, as I said, about half the projects around DECA start out as Dean's crazy ideas. And one day, now probably 15 years ago, I was after a late night at work. I was on my way home, happened to stop for, you know, all 4 food groups at the mall and to pick up a bunch of parts, I think, at a Radio Shack. And as I was going into this nice, modern, low, one-story mall, drizzly evening, I watched this very robust guy, young, not some doddering person, rugged guy that was missing his legs, trying to get up the curb, out of the parking lot, into the mall, and he couldn't do it. And a guy helped, and I helped him. Wow, isn't that humiliating? And then I'm in the mall running around and Radio Shack, and I see the guy go by, and he can't get things off a shelf. And then I literally run into the guy the third time that same evening, and I'm buying my ice cream at the counter height food court, and this guy is behind me, and he can't do this transaction. And I just thought, this is crazy. I've got a helicopter sitting on the roof of my building, and I can do pirouettes off this building and land at my house without ever touching the ground in between. And here in a modern shopping mall, a guy that otherwise is perfectly capable but just doesn't walk literally can't function and can't have the dignity that we all take for granted and go where he wants to go. So in one of those not very lucid moments, I decided, we'll fix this. So the next morning, I go in and I tell all my guys, we're going to figure out a way to do what should come after, quote, the wheelchair. And we spent months, I mean, again, I have my day job and my standard clients, but lots of late nights and pizza and beer, and I have the world's best prototype shop, and I got lots of guys that do kinematics, dynamics, controls, servos. We're going to make the coolest thing in the world to get a guy up and down stairs. Should it be a tank? Should it be We spent a number of months, and we were humbled. We found lots of ways to make a device that'll climb stairs and do it. But in the process, you make a device that's got such a large base, it'll be so heavy, it'll be so complex, the trade-off would not be worth it. So we more or less packaged that Dean's stupid idea, and months went by, we were off doing other things. And one day I get out of the shower in the morning. I hate to be corny, but it's true. It's one of those in the shower insights. And as I get out of the shower, the floor is wet. It's a nice polished granite floor. And I step out, and as I step out, I hydroplane, and of course you're anticipating a little friction. So your center of mass, you know, forces, torques, you sum them separately. Well, my feet are going out from under me. The angle of momentum isn't going to be pretty. I start doing what you learn to do as a baby, swinging your arms backwards. Oh, okay, that's angular momentum. And because remember, it's not love that makes the world go round. It is angular momentum. Anyway, I go sliding up against the opposite wall, wet and cold, but I didn't fall. And as I'm standing there, I'm thinking, why are we trying to build a static machine to do what legs do? And as I'm standing there, don't be too graphic about this, but anyway, I'm standing there, I'm thinking, you know, every mother remembers their kid's first steps. It's such an unusual characteristic to be dynamically stabilized, to put your center of mass 3, 4, 5 feet in the air on a 9-inch base. It's ridiculous. But it gives us all the advantages, as well as this unique human capability and this dignity. So I head into work. I said, look, everybody, we were solving the wrong problem. When somebody loses the ability to walk, it's not mobility that they got to get back. I mean, put them in a wheelbarrow. They're mobile, right? But a human being is not a sack of potatoes. What we got to do is reconnect the brain and the mind with the capability to be on 2 points, to be at eye level, to walk up and down stairs, because you're only on 2 points, so you can... And so I said, you know, the inner ear, a gyro, processing it, the brain, you know, we ought to just understand human balance, put that back into a two-wheel device, one substituting for each leg, and all the rest, that'll be the hard part, but all the rest of it'll be easy. Took us, actually, for the engineers among you, it's a relatively straightforward problem. It's the inverted pendulum problem, you know, one second order inhomogeneous partial differential equation. The rest of it's just engineering. And so we solved the inverted pendulum problem. Now make it fail operative, you know, on a flight of stairs, multiple processors, multiple gyros, you know, reboot with grandma on the stairs is not an option. So we spent the next couple of years proving to ourselves we could build fail operative systems that would include enough sensors, enough gyros, enough power supplies. It's basically the world's most sophisticated autonomous robot. But we knew it would be a big deal for people. We spent the next few years in our typical model, okay, go to a big company. Go to a big company with this. Well, most of the stuff I do, for, as I said, big pharma companies. They have huge R&D budgets. They understand that life's about pushing to the next limit. You know, they think nothing of, will that work? Proteomics, genomics, you roll $1 billion, it works, doesn't work, try the next drug. Well, wheelchairs? If you think an iBot's a wheelchair, go to a wheelchair company. Well, I mean, to a wheelchair company, you know, R&D is a hammer and a blowtorch.
And there aren't that many of them.
Right. So we said, all right, we just built the world's most sophisticated autonomous 11 processor real-time threat. You know, who do I take it to? Well, there is no company out there right. In the medical field to take it to. So who's the largest medical products pharmaceutical company in the world? A Johnson & Johnson. So I went to see their chairman. Said, you need to see this. Think of it like an orphan drug. You know, hopefully there won't be millions of people that need these things, but statistics doesn't work if you're the one that can't walk, or your wife, or your father, or your children. Let's put this in production, and let's give this to the people that need it. And Johnson & Johnson agreed that they would help us put that in production, and they did. And
they're did they up. Form a company? I mean, I'm trying to think of...
Yes, they formed a new company. Johnson & Johnson, as it turns out, and I guess in business school speak, I've come to realize, isn't really a company. It's sort of like the mother of all venture capital organizations. They have like 200 operating companies. But they operate them all as, you know, independent entities. And so since, as I had known, there is nobody that would currently around that could sell such a device, they formed a company to do that.
So before we get to the water project, you told me once that everything you do begins with the thought of how to improve healthcare, how to improve the health of someone, but like I said, the iBot led to the Segway. Was the Segway a kind of offshoot? Was it a culmination?
Well,
and are you? Does it delight you or chagrin you that you're maybe best known for the Segway?
You have to have a sense of humor about that kind of thing. What happened was, so we make an iBot, and we had spent years and years making an iBot. And we solve the tough problem, make it balance, and not only make it balance, but make it balance while it literally walks up and down, you know, stairs. All of what it does, a simple subset from a technical point of view of that, is a segue. There are a couple of really good reasons to make a segue. One selfish one, which I'll tell you, the others are analytic. Most of the products we make, we find other places to use the core technology, the dialysis machine. We had to invent ways to make pumping systems, valving systems, measuring systems, but the market's big enough that we could spend $10 million tooling it. Then somebody comes along and says, Dean, there are people that have scleroderma, basically T-cell lymphoma. We've got to take their blood out, run it through. You could never design a piece of equipment to do that for them, but wait a minute. I could take all this core technology, modify the machine a little bit. So we use our technology over and over again because our business model, which I didn't know there was a business model, that was told to me, but we keep all our core technology. We deal with all these large companies by giving them rights to have it in their field, and we never compete with them, so they're our partners, but we have hundreds and hundreds of patents that we can apply, and so we use it multiply. Well, the selfish reason that it was fun to do this segue is no matter what we do in our core technology and how many other places we get to use it, we've never made fun products. I mean, I love my home hemo machine, but I mean, I can't look at you and say, you know, this machine is so, I can't wait till you have end-stage renal failure so you can try this thing out. You know, or even the iBot. We're very proud of the iBot. People get in it, they get emotional, they cry, but I mean, I wouldn't say to you, I hope you get hit by a truck on the way home tonight. So we don't make stuff. We're very proud of it. We enjoy what we do, but we don't make stuff that's fun to use. Mm-hmm. So we make this iBot, and then, you know, I and a bunch of engineers, here's my selfish reason, you know. Take the seat off it, take the cluster off it, put this thing down, everything we've learned about balance, stand on it. In the control system for you control streaks, you know, there's an integrator in the pitch your and roll loop. If you take the integrator, set a coefficient to zero on the pitch axis, you get rid of the joystick on the iBot, and it's a segue. And it puts a smile on people's faces. I said, this, we actually can make something that we want somebody to buy. And wouldn't that be exciting? The more practical reason I really didn't go license it to anybody else with two things. I wanted to drive the cost of high-performance servos, amplifiers, motors as low as I could get so we could make the iBot at a reasonable price. You know, sophisticated robots cost $1 million. We're trying to sell an iBot for $20,000+. You got to get volume up. And little tiny power amps that put out a few kilowatts, you need them in the iBot, you need them in the Segway. Little motors, solid-state gyros. So it was a way to help that. But more than that, I was afraid even if we did know people in the industry that would want to go build Segways, what industry? Not the car companies. Well, you know, jet skis, snowmobiles, that's what we needed, an urban version of a device that makes noise and tears up either your lakes or your forests. So, well, what if we could make it so it's not a toy? What if we could make it so that it could be used as an efficient means of transportation in congested areas that are primarily built for pedestrians? I mean, at the time, it seemed to me, wow, this is 6-7 years ago, and I was saying to people, you know, sooner or later, people are going to figure out that, you know, the price of oil was, it's going to get over $30 a barrel. I knew it was. And I thought in 2000 that people are going to start figuring out that there really is an environmental issue. I mean, I bet someday maybe some guy's going to win the Nobel Prize for pointing that out. I don't know. But it seemed to me that if we could take this little machine and not substitute for cars any more than a car substitute for an airplane. You know, like you cross the continent, use an airplane. You get on the highway between cities at 60 miles an hour, use a car. But more than half of humanity is living in dense urban areas. I mean, and a city needs a car like a fish needs a bicycle. So it seemed to me if we could make a device that could be easy to learn to use and could cruise along at no more than 7 or 8 miles an hour. The 20 largest cities in the world, by the richest cities, Paris, New York, the poorest, biggest cities, you know, Bangkok, they all have one thing in common. The average rate of speed between any two addresses, whether you take a subway, a cab, whatever, these are well documented because time is money. For the last 100 years in urban centers, the average speed is 8 miles an hour. Well, the reason everybody builds entire subway systems, the reason we pay $20 to sit in the back of a cab, take your life in your hands. No matter what you do, no matter which option you choose, as you arbitrage, how am I going to get from 34th Street to 57th Street? No matter how much you don't like it, whether it's cost or the noise in the subway, you do it because even though you're frustrated in the back of that car, creeping along at 8 miles an hour, sucking up the exhaust of the guy in front of you, in a machine that was, you know, optimized and designed to go 60 miles an hour with six people, and you're sitting at 8 miles an hour. The reason you do it is your other alternative is walking. And you walk at between 1.6 and 2 miles an hour. So that 10-minute cab ride at 8 would be a 40-minute walk. Nobody has that extra half hour, no matter what it costs. So what if you could cruise down an urban environment at 8 miles an hour? You'd be competitive with every other mode of transportation. You're 150 times more energy efficient. It's virtually free. It's fun. It's environmentally friendly. You know, this will be a good idea. So we said, why don't we convince some people to give it a try and try to keep it as a serious tool until, you know, it's a long story. But anyway, we'll see.
So it seems to me that there's a kind of correlation or kind of resonance of that with the water project that you mentioned just a moment ago. Talk to us a little about that, because again, that's rooted in, it's not typically a medical, and in fact, we've got some images here right behind us, not typically a medical device, but as you say, it affects the health of millions.
Well, to all of you that don't think water is a medical device, let me give you some data. I don't know how many of you are biomedical. I don't know the break, but I've got med students here. But if you could, every disease you can think of that has a name, heart disease, cancer, all cancer, for the women, all your ovarian, all your breast cancer, for the guys, colon cancer and prostate, all cancers combined. Diabetes, it's rampant. Diabetes, just in America alone, type 1s, type 2s, 21 million, around the world, 275 million. Alzheimer's, dementia, end-stage renal failure, all the diseases that you can think of that somebody has, chronic disease, add them all together, it's 50% of the people that are right now on this planet chronically ill. All by itself, the other 50% is the fact that people are drinking water with cryptosporidia, gerardia, inorganics, organics, heavy metals. 50% of all human disease is waterborne pathogens. So, it seemed to me we should just solve that problem. It would be low-hanging fruit. We could then, you know, I don't know how to solve the others. They will be solved, by the way, places like Stanford. We'll spend billions in the end, hundreds of billions, to one by one solve all these other diseases, and they will be solved. But the two reasons, and I think we got to go after the water, one is the pure logic of it's low-hanging fruit. Let's go after that one. And the other is, it's a moral problem not to. You know, you might end up with glioblastoma tomorrow, so might I. Whether you're the richest guy in the world or the poorest guy in the world, we're both in deep you-know-what, because you got about 6 months. It's a tragedy, but it's not a moral problem. We're all in it together. But the water problem? You and I are not going to die like 5 million kids will this year. It's a problem we know how to solve, and it won't cost trillions. So I decided, not that I don't have a day job and my first and my other not-for-profits, but we should spend a few nights and weekends and wipe out the global water problem. It seemed like a good idea. And it's harder than you think, but not from a technical point of view. From a technical point of view, we solved it. We really did.
It's the political issue.
It's not hubris. We solved it. We listened to all the experts explain to us that, well, you got cryptosporidia or any kind of bioburden in your water, you use chlorine. You can kill it. Well, you go to Bangladesh, where they don't want to die tomorrow of all the immediate causes of death when you take water that's got bioburden in it. And they do what we do in North America. You dig deep wells, you get below the bioburden, the earth cleans up its water. There's no fecal matter floating around in a well a few hundred feet deep. But, well, in that part of the world, you have a different problem. In North America, you dig a deep well, you get through the bioburden, but you typically come to minerals and metals like iron. It's a terrible problem. It puts spots on your glasses. It's really awful. In Asia, the metal you come to isn't iron. It's arsenic. It puts spots on your liver, and you die. About 1.5 million wells in Bangladesh alone are contaminated by arsenic. Oh, well, the chlorine won't do much for that. And then you go around the world, and you look at the 1.6 million people that don't have water, and every day they make a choice between drinking nothing, which is not an option, or risking their lives and their kids' lives. And it turns out that all the experts that for the last 60 or 70 years, certainly since the World Bank, the United Nations, all these big organizations have decided to solve it. They optimized the engineering solution. Near the ocean, build a desalinization plant. 1 million gallons a day. You can do it if you have the infrastructure and the power. If you're in a small, if you're in a place that has, you know it's bioburden, use chlorine tablets. If you're in Bangladesh and you got wells that are contaminated with heavy metals, use activated charcoal filters. And all over the world, if you know exactly what's wrong with your water, there's a brilliant engineering particular solution that'll solve that problem. And they've been trying to implement it. They've spent, by their own numbers, in 60 years, $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. But there's not a lot of places in the world where the problem has been solved by these technologies. And we looked at that and said, you know, maybe we need a different perspective. Maybe you shouldn't be trying to reduce the unit cost of the water to the lowest possible amount, because a chlorine tablet can do a metric ton of water. So it's a fraction. It's a fraction of a cent. It's a hundredth of a cent a liter. If you just draw the box around, this was the problem, this is the solution, chlorine will do it if it's bioburden. It's maybe 4 or 5 times that amount to even desalinate salt water if you have a big plant and scale and a city of 1 million people. That's why we in a sophisticated world do it that way. If you know you have a well and you know the only contaminant is heavy metal, use activated charcoal if you can run down and get a new filter tomorrow. If you know how to do it, if you know how to analyze the water, if you can pre-test it, pre-treat it, post-test it. And they've done that, and they've optimized the technology using the mental model that we all have for the world. But I looked at it and said, supposing that's not the problem. Supposing the problem is really that of the 1.6 billion people, all of whom are poor, most of whom have no education, 900 million of which live in relatively small villages. They don't have the scale for the big plant. They don't have the infrastructure. They can't go to 7-Eleven or Walmart to get new filters or new. They don't know how much chlorine to put in, because if you put in too much, you're sick. If you don't put in enough, you're sick. They don't have in the little villages an epidemiologist, a microbiologist, an organic chemist. How are they going to know how to do all of this stuff? So we said, let's just build them a box. And the goal will be not to make the water the absolute cheapest, but let's build a box that has two lines on it. One is a line that you put into anything that looks wet, the ocean, a septic system, a latrine, anything that looks wet. And out of the other end will come drinkable water. By the way, if you look at the picture before this one, what I was going to show you, if you go back one, I took this picture finally when I had my epiphany that it's not the technology, stupid. I took this picture to all the experts. By the way, the reason I know they're experts is because they told me. So anyway, I said, which of your brilliant solutions do you use in a place like this? Not a lot of people would use osmosis membranes. I don't think they'll be destroyed by the chemical.
Can we talk about the prosthetic arm for?
Yeah.
Can we take an extra 10 minutes even though?
The prosthetic arm.
Five. We're at okay. Risk on. Right. Can we talk about the prosthetic arm? And then we
a
can talk about
arm.
First out in the first competition out in the thing.
I will speak as quickly as I can. A long time ago in a faraway place, I was visited by the head of DARPA, Tony Tether, and a bunch of Army surgeons who said, we've had 1,600 kids already come back from Iraq, missing an arm, fully shoulder disarticulated, missing an arm. 2 dozen of them have come back missing two. Now, if you think missing an arm is bad, missing two makes that seem like an inconvenience. He told me he wanted to be able to have these kids literally not have the hook we've been putting on them since Civil War. He wanted me to give him something that weighed no more than the original equipment, that would fit on a 50th percentile female frame, that would allow these people to pick up a raisin or a grape without breaking it or dropping it, and articulate it into their mouths. Don't break it, don't drop it, and know the difference. So he wanted efferent and afferent signals, haptic response. I thought about it. I said, maybe 4 years. He said, I'll give you two. I said, we got to figure out how to connect it. I'll have to make the long story short, but he gave me a list of places, including Stanford, that are doing interesting neurological work. I'm going to show you what we had in 11 months. Double click it. So 11 months, don't be impressed yet by this, because this is one of my engineers wearing it. It weighs 8.9 pounds. It's got 14 degrees of freedom. It abducts and flexes at the shoulder, rotates at the elbow and the wrist, has 11 degrees in the hand, including 3 in the index finger alone, 2 in the thumb. And you'd say, isn't that incredible? Now he can go and pick up with an opposed thumb and index finger, rotate at the wrist, or he can put it down and use a power grip with a fist. He can, by the way, curl 40 pounds and read. And you'd say, that's amazing, isn't it? Well, for 11 months, we were pretty proud of that. 14 degrees of freedom, processors in each one, all linked together, smooth, power supplies, everything is included, 8.9 pounds. However, that's the easy part. Now we want to make it controllable. That guy was doing it because another guy was running it like a mannequin. This guy is thinking. He wore this thing for less than one day, and he was able to do this. We have 8 surface EMG electrodes on this guy, and at the end of one day, he could do that. The following morning, by the way, there's only a 10-second one I'll show you. Not only was he able to do it by thinking, it became a lower brainstem function, because watch this. If we go to the next one, it's very short, but he picks up a glass, and he starts to drink, but he's concentrating. But watch the last second. As he hears us start applauding, he looks up at the camera. Without even concentrating, he puts the glass down, not even looking. Zip. This guy has turned it into the same kind of function that you and I have. That was a day and a half of using it.
How far away from seeing this light up?
A couple of weeks after that, which is about 15 months from the day we started, I was asked to bring it to Washington to let the guys down there see what these things do. This guy has no arms. You're seeing the dynamic response he has. We took him down, and in the Capitol, he and this other guy did the following. We gave them each a little ball. These guys have no arms. They're going to pass that between them. These are extraordinary people. They want to help each other. This guy's going to pour a glass of water for his friend. We introduced these guys to each other the day before that. I put them in the back of my plane, flew them down there. I think they were, it was an astounding. Now, by the way, this is what they asked me for. He's picking up grapes without breaking them or dropping them and eating them. I asked him at the end of 3 hours of demoing that in Washington, how are you doing? He said, Dean, I'm doing fine, but do I have to eat another grape?
Well, we're right up against time. I knew that this would be impossible to contain within an hour. There's also, Dean is behind a very fascinating project called the FIRST Competition, which is it has high school students working on robot projects. I know we've got a lot of high schools here. If I can, and I went against myself, I wanted to leave time for questions, but I think hearing Dean tell a story was just so valuable. Let's go over to where the Sandy wants to say something. What's that? Should we do one question?
We need to look at 3 pictures because all of you need to participate in FIRST, which is a nonprofit we put together.
Show us three pictures.
15 years ago, I convinced 23 companies to adopt 23 local high schools and prove that if you showed any kids, particularly women and minorities from the inner cities, what engineering is like, you could jazz them up and get them interested.
This is the Georgia Dome?
With 15 years of compound growth of 50% per year, 23 schools that participated in 1992 became last year 13,000 schools running regionals in 39 cities around the United States, including one funded by Google here in California. There's 4 in California. One's Qualcomm down San Diego. In any event, this is what the pit area looked like in the Georgia Dome where we held our finals last year. Next slide. 38% of the kids on the teams are women and minorities. 61,000 scientists and engineers donated 6 weeks of their time last year to mentor these kids. I realize that most of you are not at risk of not having careers. You're lucky. You're advantaged. And you owe something to the world. And in your own enlightened self-interest, we've got to get more smart people out there. Right now, this earth we inhabit seems to be like an asylum being run by the inmates. We've got to get more smart people, particularly in this country. Women and minorities need to be part of the solution.
those people that we're going to try to give power and water to, at least for the next 10 years, are living on a dollar a day. They got bigger local immediate issues. They are not going to solve the world's problems. You are. Let's start by giving the group of people that are part of the problem solvers an advantage of scale. We are signing up teams again. We have 125 universities that are adopting high schools. Last year on stage at the Georgia Dome, we gave out $11 million in scholarships to these kids. Some of these kids ought to be coming to Stanford. Some of the kids in some of the towns around here should be mentored by some of you. The regional this year, first week in March, will be at San Jose State. You need to get involved. You need to give back. The kickoff is in January. You have plenty of time to align yourself with some kids that need to see what serious people do. So I agree to come to these things because I need support.
Well, giving back is a great place to end. I'm sorry we don't have time for questions. If you linger any more than 5 minutes, you will be taking a test. But if you can get out of here in 5 minutes, we'll continue the conversation with Dean across the hall. Thanks, Dean.